Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silk reporting from Edinburgh in lockdown. And I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano, who is two blocks away, but a million miles away during lockdown time. So how are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you very much. I'm doing doing fine.
We are all safely ensconced in our flats, avoiding social contact of all kinds, except digitally. So what we thought we would do today is talk about this very bizarre situation. I think, what was it, one quarter of the world is facing right now, of being in some kind of social isolation lockdown, and what all that sort of means, and how we're trying to sort of stay sane during all of this, because we're in unusual, uncharted territories in lots of ways.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably going to be a less historically focused episode, because we don't have as much to say about this in terms of precedents. It's more how what we're doing as academics, I suppose, who are locked down. I would say, if I may, David, I'd like to say hello to a listener I encountered the other day before we were locked down.
Yes. This is how we communicate with all our friends now, is via our podcast. Okay, good. So
I want to say hello to Mike from Edinburgh. I was out walking around the meadows near our, large park, which is very which your flat overlooks.
Yes.
Near the university, and I was walking around the meadows the other day before the stronger lockdown requirements came into force, and I ran into Mike and his son. And Mike is a listener. In fact, Mike asked if we're going to be recording more episodes, and I assured him we are. We will. And so, hello, Mike, and to all our listeners out there, we hope you're safe and well.
Yes, and healthy, and all kinds of things. Yes. Yeah. So this is, I mean, how unprecedented, Frank, do you think this time is? I mean, can we think of other, I mean, there's not much in terms of historical antecedent that fits this particular moment we're in.
I mean, there are various plague moments in history, and I have to confess I'm not really an expert in those, but at periodic times when people have lived under quarantine, although those haven't been necessarily been global in scope. They might have been global in impact, but not global in the sense that, as you said, one quarter of humanity, I think it is theoretically under some kind of quarantine or isolation at the moment. So I can't think of a precedent like that. There are times in history when people have been sort of shuttered in their homes, either during wartime or due to extreme – we were talking about this before we came on the air – but due to extreme weather.
Yeah.
So I guess there are a few cases in history, but I can't think of a moment like this when so many people have been kind of confined to their homes. Can you?
Well, I mean, the – so many people. The one time that occurs to me is there were, and this I think serves is playing out the same today. During the 1918 flu epidemic, different communities had different sort of levels of social distancing, to use the modern term, that they sort of enforced upon their population, both around the world and around the United States. And I guess the examples people are drawing right now is Philadelphia said basically, let's continue running things as normally, and some other communities, most notably St. Louis, decided to basically shut everything down. And famously, Philadelphia had a Liberty Loan parade. This is obviously in the end of the First World War, and 72 hours after this huge parade with soldiers and Boy Scouts and what have you, all of the hospitals in Philadelphia were full with people with the flu, whereas St. Louis decided to shut down their schools and theaters and pool halls and all the kinds of things. But even then, there wasn't the kind of shuttering, telling people to stay in their homes, to quite the same degree as there is right now.
I guess that variable behavior is interesting, because we've seen that in response to COVID-19, in the sense that, at the moment, where in Italy, which of course is the epicenter in Europe, where there are really, really horrible scenes have been playing out for the past month or so. There really is, in Italy and Spain, there seems to be a complete lockdown with people unable to leave their homes. And then there's a kind of spectrum of behavior. We here in the UK at the moment are allowed to go out to take exercise once a day. You can go out to walk your dogs or if you need to, and things like that, and obviously to shop for food. So it's not a total lockdown. Whereas, and then in we've seen a kind of complete lockdown in places like San Francisco, whereas in other parts of the United States there isn't. And President Trump is suggesting that people should all be back to normal by Easter time and all packing the churches. I'm not sure that's a good idea. So there's been a spectrum of behavior. Even now where there are lockdowns, they're not all the same. My daughter is in Sweden at the moment, and Sweden has had quite an interesting... is a bit of an outlier in this. I don't know whether you've seen this. Sweden, there's a bit of a Swedish experiment going on, which is, well, because I have a personal stake in this, I hope it works. They have gone even further. Britain embraced, at least at the beginning, concept of, you know, herd immunity, which is, okay, we're not going to lock people down. We're not going to be too... we're not going to constrain people too much, more or less in the hope that most people will get a mild case of coronavirus and then develop immunity. And since then, things have deteriorated quite considerably in certain parts of the UK, particularly in London. And as a result, we have this more stringent regime in place. Sweden has kind of, at least till now, embraced more of the herd immunity concept and also assumed... that people will take sensible precautions without requiring them to take sensible precautions. And so it's been very... And I read an article about this yesterday in Foreign Policy, which made an interesting case that because Swedes have a long tradition of having independent public bodies, politically independent public bodies that, you know, administer public health and things like this, and they're trusted by the public... that they're willing to kind of listen to those and follow the advice they're given. My daughter, and I hasten to add, she is half Swedish, says, well, Sweden's a perfect place to be because they've got a very good health service, and they social distancing is what they do all the time anyway. Nobody talks to anybody. She said, I've been living in this flat for a year and a half. I barely speak to my neighbors. And she said they practice social isolation, and nobody touches each other. so, notwithstanding those cultural peculiarities those unique cultural traits, the having a political culture where people still trust experts and trust the government and follow advice, it's an interesting outlier. I guess there's a spectrum of behavior, if you will, from a complete lockdown on one end to a kind of laissez-faire, let everybody do what they want, as we're seeing in places like Oklahoma at the other, and then there's something in between. And I'd say that here in Britain, we've moved from the laissez-faire end of the spectrum more towards a kind of enforced social control, but we're not under the same degree of control as other parts of Europe or other parts of the world. But I don't know what, but as far as historic precedents,
yeah.
I suppose going back to your 1918 example, you know, Philadelphia would have been at one end and St. Louis at the other end of that spectrum.
Right. You know, and there are times when people have sort of thought they'd have to prepare for these kinds of lockdowns and obviously didn't. You know, we think about the sort of the construction of fallout shelters in the late 50s and early 60s, and when, you know, which thousands, hundreds of thousands of Americans built these, you know, underground bunkers in their basements or in, you know, in their yards or what have you, you know, planning to be socially isolated for, you know, weeks, if not months, if not years. And I've been looking at that this morning, figuring out, okay, so what are they planning on doing during those times together as a family? And there's surprisingly little about what actually life in a fallout shelter would, you know, reading the sort of magazine articles. There's lots about how to construct these things and how to stock them, but very little about how you sort of maintain your sanity in that context. All the pictures of people in fallout shelters are always reading books, but they don't seem to have a lot of books. And so the question I was sort of wondering about, like, you know, which books do you take down there, and when do you get bored with reading it? Yeah, it's
yes,
not...
shelf space
in a fallout shelter. You know,
and of course they're always smiling and they look happy because it's basically a kind of 1950s or 60s living room transported into a underground shelter.
Sure, there's interesting ways in which sort of the gender dynamics of 1950s. Families is sort of reinscribed inside what life in these fallout shelters would have been.
That's
like,
right.
If people had been using them.
It's certainly based on social media accounts from many people that I know. People are finding being at home permanently with their families to be particularly, well, rewarding in unique ways, let's just say, or challenging.
Exactly, yes. Well, I mean, I think, you know, people's experience with this lockdown is very different. You know, if you have young children, you know, and obviously people who are trying to work from home and care and educate their young children is a particularly robust set of challenges. So
yes, the former rapper and now actor Ice-T, who's in Law and Order Special Victims Unit, who you may know. Are you familiar with?
I'm familiar with his oeuvre. Yes, you know, from Cop Killer all the way to Cop on TV. Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, he tweeted. Yeah, this is a lesson to all those tough guys who think they can do time.
Yes.
You know, you couldn't spend 2 days at home.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So which makes you think, yeah, living in a fallout shelter might not be all it was cracked up to be.
But we've
seen with survivalists, and not just survivalists, there's a trend among the uber wealthy in the past decade or so to build basically grander fallout shelters, sort of places they could escape to, refuges in you know, usually in very, very rural parts of whatever country they live in. So you know they're almost James Bond villain type lairs, but so there are kind of echoes of that we see in contemporary culture as well.
Yeah, with you know, sort of Y2K preppers and people who are stockpiling foods and things. And there's a I don't know whether that's more common in the United States than in the rest of the world, but there seems to be something very particular about, the sense of how one survives these particular scenarios. And obviously,
yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, one of the things that many people have noted is that sort of gun sales in the past 2 weeks have been at extraordinarily high levels, and it's unclear exactly what people need guns for in this particular situation because the coronavirus is not susceptible to firearms, but
I saw a story the other day. We've been watching because of the Swedish connection in my life. We've been watching every day we watch the news from Swedish television as well as the BBC in the US, and there was a story on Swedish TV covering that very phenomenon. And my response was very similar to yours, where you don't need a gun to deal with a virus. But they were talking to people in the U.S. who were either buying guns or more likely they were already gun owners and they were stockpiling ammunition. And their argument was, the person they interviewed some people who were actually reasonably sensible, and they said, well, you know, we don't know what's going to happen in terms of, you know, if this spreads as widely as they expect it to spread, then there will be no police. Or there may be no police and no police protection. So it wasn't as simple as I'm going to buy a gun because I'm afraid of getting sick. It was, and I thought, oh, I hadn't thought of that. I'm not advocating that, but there is a logic there.
Yeah. So Marshall, you know, the chaos will break out. We'll all need to defend ourselves.
Which
you know,
is part of the myth of the whole that underlies the Second Amendment in any way.
Yeah. It's going to be Mad Max everywhere. All right. So what are you doing now that you know we're in this, other than watching Swedish television and the BBC? How are you managing to how are you filling your time now? Because we're obviously all of our schedules are thrown out the window by all of this.
Well, two things. I think we should attack this on two levels, which is how are you working? How are we working? And then, as you say, what are you filling your time with when you're not working? And so I, for reasons we don't need to get into, don't in the spring semester don't have as heavy a teaching load as you do. But I am I'm more interested to hear how you're coping with online teaching. But we'll get to that in a second. In terms of my own teaching, I'm you know, seeing, and I'm using air quotes here, students, dissertation students, both undergraduates and graduate students, using all manner of platforms. So Skype, Zoom, Microsoft Meetings, sometimes the telephone.
That's a very strange.
It's
okay.
Cutting-edge technology, David. It's really going to go places. and so having lots of consultations, and it's actually it's tricky because the technology is much better than it was even a couple years ago. But it's still tricky, and there, you know, you drop signals and everything else, and you're fighting with your family for bandwidth, literally. And so there are challenges, but it's also quite sweet in its way. I've actually enjoyed those conversations with students because everybody's kind of pulling together and realizing that we're all kind of facing the same adversity, and it's nice to talk to people.
Yes.
And so I've been doing a fair bit of that. I've also been attending meetings, and I'm, again, you put that in air quotes, because of my administrative responsibilities relating to international aspects of the university. So alumni engagement and recruitment in the U.S., and we're talking about how in Canada and how we're going to deal with those things in coming months. And I've been involved in a little bit of planning, and it's not really appropriate to discuss it now about what we might be doing in coming months at the university, because this, you know, you, I think, have been at the kind of sharp end of things as far as delivering teaching to finish the semester we're already on, we're in the midst of. But we have to think about what next year is going to look like, because we don't know how prolonged this is going to be. So I've been attending and using the same technology. I've been very impressed that most people I've dealt with, whether they be students or colleagues, really are trying to do their best, and most people are acting in a very positive spirit. So I found that quite, you know, I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish about this, but quite uplifting.
Yeah, I've had the same experience, right? That people are
people are good, David.
Yeah. Oh. Yes, people on the whole are good. I would agree with that sentiment.
Some people are not, but a lot of people are good in general. But you have a much heavier teaching load right now than I do, and we, of course, were involved in industrial action, which now seems like a lifetime ago, but the universities across the UK, there was prolonged and widespread industrial action more or less right before this pandemic hit. And now we're dealing with the pandemic, but you have a much heavier teaching load at the moment than I do, just again for reasons we don't need to go into. How are you delivering your teaching to undergraduates, and in particular, but you know, what's your experience like?
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of weird because we only have we missed several weeks for the industrial action, and then we've had, you know, a week off to plan online teaching. We had that sort of transitionary week. And then we've only had we're sort of at the very end of the semester now anyways. We don't have that many weeks of online teaching. It's not like some of our colleagues in the United States who are switching halfway through the semester but then have 6, 7, or 8 weeks of online teaching. We've only going to really have 2 or 3. And I've taught online before, both here at Edinburgh and at other places where I've taught. So I have some experience doing the online teaching, but it's obviously a very different scenario switching halfway through a semester than it is if it's a course that's designed to be online, and where the students signed up to be in an online course. The experience I've had, and I'm teaching a fourth year class. I'm teaching some master's students this semester. We've been doing a synchronous class because we only have a few weeks left. So we're all meeting at the same time. And some people, other places are doing asynchronous teaching, which also works pretty well. But I found it was really helpful to have, people all in the same virtual space for a couple of hours. The students are telling me is they're finding it very rewarding to sort of, at least for that 2 hour window, do something that seems somewhat normal in a situation that is obviously very abnormal, that, to escape into the 19th century, which is usually not a very pleasant place to escape to, seems actually like a very, nice escape, for a couple of hours. I've had a very rewarding experience this past week teaching, and doing lots and lots of meetings with students. And I'm looking forward to another sort of week or two of online teaching, because I think it's obviously the plans I had at the beginning of the semester and beginning of the year are all out the window in terms of what I wanted to do with this semester, the kinds of ways in which I wanted to sort of bring out various themes over a series of weeks, but you know, you have to sort of reframe things and sort of go with what you've got. And I'm grateful to the students for putting in, you know, a really prodigious amount of effort in the face of all of this, and this has been a really great challenge for them as well. And they're obviously, some of them are dealing with really serious things above and beyond the academic challenges. You know, a lot of students are working in the service industry, which is shut down. So a lot of them have lost their jobs. Some of them are being required to work more because of the whatever kinds of employment they have. And so it's and obviously people are dealing with relocating. Some of them moved home. Some of them have to deal with issues with sick members of their families. So it's I'm really in awe of the work that students have done this semester, given everything they faced. And the industrial action by itself would have been a huge challenge to their educational experience, but then having this on top of it is just you know, crazy.
And let's not forget, they're going to, if some of them will become ill or have
to, to be sure. Yes, right. Yes.
I mean, one thing that surprised me, and this is an observation, not a criticism of any, in any way, I have been surprised to learn, we assume that students are all digital natives. In other words, they grew up in a digital world, they grew up in a digital environment. You know, we did not. You know, we can remember an analog world. And that's true on one level, but I've been surprised at the degree to which some of them really have been as challenged by the technology as I have. Well, it's simply an observation. I don't know what the majority of them are much more comfortable in the digital domain than I am, for example, and I'm considerably older than they are. But one or two of them, you know, I've been kind of talking them through, okay, this is what you click on, this is what you do.
Yeah.
That shouldn't surprise me, I suppose, but it did.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're facing some really serious challenges. I mean, not all of them have the same. I think our students are, for the most part, have fairly good internet access at home and what have you. But not all of them do. And people are teaching in other locations, especially with student populations that are coming from disadvantaged backgrounds. You know, going home and working at home is not always particularly easy, given their family situation, given their sort of internet access and what have you. So it's a real set of challenges students are facing. You know, there's the technological challenges, the challenges of students who are trying to do research, facing all of this, and that's, you know, the plans they had are all out the window now. So,
well, yeah, I assume you, like me, are dealing with a lot of MSc students who are choosing dissertation topics at the moment to write over the summer, and of course now every project has to be basically constructed on the assumption that they'll be using online resources and only online resources.
Which, in the fact that we can do that, I think is a great privilege in some ways. You know, thinking about what this would have looked like 10 years ago. You know, the number of online resources that we have, the number of manuscript stuff that we have. You know, I'm just thinking about how this is, that the availability of online sources has shaped my own work over the past 10 years. I mean, I've been able, the amount of like research I'm able to do from my dining room table is profound, which I really appreciate because I like writing at my dining room table. You know, the kinds of books and resources that I have access to. So, you know, it requires them to sort of think about different kinds of projects and ask different kinds of questions. I think the realm of online stuff is going to make this less of a insurmountable barrier than it would have been, you know, only a decade ago.
One thing I've really enjoyed is whether I'm speaking to students or colleagues or watching the news, because of course now everybody is broadcasting from their homes, is looking at people's bookcases.
Yes.
it's fascinating to see what people have on their bookshelves. I enjoy doing that when I go into people's homes as well. So it's great. Or you see people.
But students usually don't invite us into their flats. So yes, it's.
That's right. Well, and rightly so. but it's very interesting just to see what's on people's bookshelves.
Yes.
I've very much enjoyed that when I see news reports as well.
To be sure.
But it's interesting. But okay, so you're teaching. As far as your, what are you doing with the rest of your time?
I'm doing tons and tons of sort of individual meetings with students. So that is between the actual classes themselves and the Skype meetings. I think that's a lot of my time. I've been trying to do some productivity and research kinds of things. Luckily I'm at the point in my work right now where I'm actually writing a bibliography for a manuscript I finished. And so that's kind of mindless work. And so I'm sort of able to do it without, while being heavily distracted by all the things that are going on. Doing actual sort of serious original research may be pretty challenging right now. I think everyone's has their own sort of threshold about what they can handle, both in terms of their distractions at home and in terms of their sort of mental focus in this weird space.
I'm about to start a new chapter. That sounds like I'm talking about my life. in my current project, and so I'm doing a lot of reading and research for that, which is great. But I am finding it difficult to do sustained periods of research because there's just so much else going on. Whether there are kind of demands on my time from work, but also just there are so many other demands on our
emotional energy. Resources,
yeah, our emotional energy. That's right. One thing I've done that I think has been really helpful is I've stopped watching the news. I watch the news as I normally watch the news, which is maybe once a day, rather than treating this, my previous pattern, and I am quite interested in the news and follow it quite closely in all kinds of ways. I think like many people, I would kind of read newspapers online or in print, follow things on Twitter, watch the news, and then when a big story happened, you kind of immerse yourself and do it quite intensively. I did that at the beginning of this, but it's just so all-encompassing and ongoing that to do that, you could do that all day, every day. And I've reverted to, okay, I'm only going to watch the news at, once a day or twice a day, trying to stay off Twitter as a news source, both because it's a time suck, but also I think traditional media are a better source for information in a time like this than Twitter. I think Twitter's great when there's a breaking story. But I think actually when I want to follow, okay, what's actually happening, in response to COVID-19 or what's going on with COVID-19, I find more traditional news sources to be a better way to go. But I'm trying to only consult them a couple times a day rather than throughout the day. So turning them off during the day.
What do you do during the day then if you're not glued to Twitter, et cetera?
Well, I'm doing what you're doing in terms of, consultations with students, and I don't have as many students as you do at the moment, but those do take time.
Yeah.
Meetings. So I'm trying within working hours to do work, and then I'm also trying to work on my book and deal with things. I mean, people have been saying you need to keep a diary and everything, and I've always kept a diary for the past 20, almost 30 years.
Really?
Daily? Yeah. So I get up and I do that in the morning. I'm trying to I do exercise my once a day going outside to exercise, and I won't say right to that, at least that's the requirement or that's the allocation. So I've been doing that. So I get up in the morning. It helps that my wife is a GP, so she's working in the health service, so she's still going to work, and they're under a different kind of pressure. They're under a kind of pressure we can't comprehend, frankly.
Sure.
And so she's getting up and going to work. So I get up and I work out, and then I sit down and try to get to work and keep a structured day. Because otherwise, It felt that the first couple of days, the Swedes have a word, mellandagarna, the middle days, for the days, to describe the days between Christmas and New Year's. It's a very good expression. And you know how that period is sort of like...
there's nothing going on and everything is kind of dead.
It's quite relaxing. You lose what track of what day it is. There's a danger of that happening to us.
Yes.
And so I'm trying to avoid that by sort of keeping a structured life and making sure I'm, you know, as I said, getting some exercise, sitting down and working.
Now, I'm intrigued by your diary keeping. As a historian of a period when the people kept a lot of diaries, what drove you to keep a diary, and what are you going to do with it? What are your plans for, you know, are you going to donate this to an archive, or is that...
You know, that's a really good question, David, and it's something I ought to think about. I don't know. I mean, is it for my kids? I guess. I mean, it's not. I am not Samuel Pepys. I'm not a very good diarist, I have to confess. But I do like the discipline of doing it. So I have an unbroken streak of diary entries going. I kept it intermittently once I came to the UK, when I thought I was only going to be here for a year or two. So I started intermittently in 1992 and 93, but I have an unbroken streak of entries, I think, that goes back to 96 or 97.
Wow.
Now, some days are, you know, it's one line. Some days it's a page and a half. I guess I'll leave them with my kids. I could give them to an archive. I mean, my kids might not be interested in them. I don't know what I'll do with them. And I've gone through interesting patterns. So for the first 10 years, I did it by hand. And then there's a period in the middle when I did it. I wrote them on my computer, then, you know, saved them as encrypted files. And I became a little bit worried about that, just because digital media changes and you don't know it. And so I've actually gone back to writing them by hand in the past 2 or 3 years, and it's easier by hand, and I think it's more immediate to do it by hand, although my handwriting is terrible, so that's an issue. But I have printed copies of the digital versions that I printed and bound, you know, in case, you know, one of the challenges we face in confronting our own mortality is, what do you do with your digital legacy? But whether it's your iTunes account or whatever. And so, you know, if, you know, when I'm gone, I don't know whether people will be able to access my kids would be able to, or my wife would be able to access these diaries online. So I've printed them out as well.
Okay.
And bound them. I don't know what I mean to do with them. And as I said, I do it as a historian. I really enjoy it at some level. Sometimes it's a chore. But I mean, I think one of the things I've been doing is writing, you know, about what's going on. Now, again,
okay. I don't keep a diary because that's not something that would interest me. But my wife kept a diary for many years and kept, you know, really long bound things. But then she saw sort of what I did with people's diaries in my research. And that horrified her, because I was reading people's diaries that says do not read on the cover.
Right.
So she ended up shredding all of her diaries.
Did she? Oh, that's
about seven or 8 years ago, because she just didn't want anyone to ever read them.
Why did she keep them?
Who knows? I think, you know, she kept them because she kept them. I think it was sort of a, you know, she wrote in her diaries as a kind of meditation, if you will. And
sure.
But then I guess she saw too many of me reading people's diaries in the archives, and I think she was horrified by the idea that she would pass away at some point and all of these would end up in an archive somewhere and be read by graduate students.
It's an interesting thing, because I think if they might be harder for my children to read than they would for a historian 50 years from now who won't care about... them in a different way. I mean, so are they an insight into what it's like to be an immigrant academic in Britain in the early 21st century? Sure.
Okay.
I guess.
Future graduate students who are listening to this in 2075, if you want to, find the archive of Frank Loftus' diaries, we can write your thesis on that.
Well, I do a riff with graduate students sometimes when I do historical methodology for graduate students. When we do diaries, I mention that I keep a diary, and I usually sort of deadpan and say, you know, and you might be in it, so you better behave.
Okay, so I mean, people are lots of people who are encouraging that people keep diaries during this whole crisis, in part because it is a time where things are changing rapidly, and are, you know, things that were happening just a few days ago seem like a million years ago now, and so recording things as they happen are important. What else are you doing? You know, because this is a weird time.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'm one of the things we thought about in thinking about this episode was we were going to discuss what are you reading, listening to, and watching. And we didn't want to do a kind of COVID-19 episode per se, because there's so much of that. So I'm listening to, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I like podcasts. People listening to this podcast will be shocked to hear. But I've slightly changed my habits, because I normally listen to quite a lot of news podcasts, again, mainly American and British, but not only. And I've, again, tried to limit that in part because I want to listen to other things. I've been listening to some old-time radio podcasts.
Old-time radio, okay.
As a diversion, so particularly because, you know, you get a kind of story in 25 minutes. And so I've been listening to The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, which are, you know, Raymond Chandler's great detective, and there were a number of iterations of that radio program in the 40s and 50s, beginning with the actor Van Heflin playing Philip Marlowe. So I've been listening to that. I've been listening to, quite a few podcasts. I like, as you know, and as our listeners will probably have probably figured out, I'm a bit of a sports fan, but of course, sports has stopped. And so I listen to a lot of sports podcasts, or not a lot, but several to kind of keep up, especially if I'm following my teams from afar. Podcasts are great for that, but nothing's happening. Although there's a great, great podcast that I can recommend called Puck Soup.
Puck Soup, okay.
Puck Soup, and it's ostensibly a hockey podcast. But it's actually about all kinds of things. It's three guys, two Americans, one Canadian. The gender balance isn't great on it, like our own podcast. But they're very, very funny, and they've had, you know, the Canadian guy was telling the story about trying to get from his in-laws, visiting his in-laws in South Carolina, back to Ottawa at the beginning of the crisis as travel was shutting down. Very, very funny and very, very interesting. And so I can recommend Puck Soup, and you'd like it. They talk about lots of pop culture, lots of Star Wars,
okay,
Marvel stuff. And so I've been listening to that despite the fact there's no hockey to follow. So podcasts, TV, I've been trying to avoid binge watching too much because I don't want to spend this whole time in front of the TV. But I have, Mimi and I watched The Good Place finally. Have you seen The Good Place?
I've seen the first couple seasons. I haven't kept up since then.
Well, we finished it, and it's worth watching. And that very interesting program. I mean, very interesting kind of philosophically. So enjoyed that. Although it doesn't lend itself to binge watching anyway. When I work out in the morning, if I work out in the flat before I go outside, I've switched from the news to watching I watched the first season of Modern Family again, which I believe that was in 2009, how long ago it was and how young they all are. But I mean, I've always enjoyed Modern Family, but that first couple of seasons are very funny, really funny. And so I've enjoyed that. Going to watch the final episode of Picard tonight.
Oh, yes, that's on my to-do list as well.
People in the U.S. have already seen it, but we'll see that tonight, and I've really enjoyed that. I think it's better than I keep forgetting the name of the Discovery, the other current Star Trek series on Netflix. So I've enjoyed that. I've been listening to a lot of music and reading, and so I'm reading both for work. I think I've mentioned in the past I've been reading this. I'm reading this book about Jefferson and Washington, so I'm reading for that, both primary and secondary sources. Also work-related, I'm reading Mary Beth Norton's new book on it's on 1774. It focuses on the year 1774, really down to the spring of 1775 and looking at the outbreak of the American Revolution. And that's a really, really fine work. And I'm reading, for pleasure, I am reading The Mirror and the Light, which I mentioned a week or two ago, the new Hilary Mantel novel on, you know, concluding her Cromwell trilogy. What about you?
Well, so there's a couple of things that have been sort of intriguing me about how to I've been thinking a lot about how to spend my time during all this and what's the right balance between work, between that sort of mindless recreation stuff and whatever's in between. So I've been playing a lot of board games with my family. We've been playing lots of Ticket to Ride. We've been playing lots of Dominion. Those are games we both play a lot. We've been Azul.
I've just encountered Ticket to Ride.
Yeah, so it was a great game. So we've been doing some of that, but I've been trying to also to sort of think about, okay, is there ways, what things can I do, and what things have opened up that weren't open before, and there's some digital sort of resources for historians that used to be behind paywalls that have all opened up because of the COVID-19 crisis. And one of the great ones is Project Muse has opened up just a huge amount of material. Are you familiar with this? Project Muse is a digital. So they have journals and various other things, but they also have lots of books that are on Project Muse, but usually they're behind a paywall. Well, what's happened during this crisis is that a number of publishers have decided simply just to make their books open, at least for the next few months, on Project Muse. And so I'm just looking here at the list. So Cornell, Duke, Fordham, Johns Hopkins, UNC, Georgia, Ohio State, tons and tons. Actually, you can read all three of my books for free if you're really bored and looking for something to do during the crisis. They're all available for free. You can download them. If you're wise, you may want to go and download a ton of stuff because you don't know how long this stuff is going to be going on. And obviously the paywalls will go back up at some point. But that's an amazing resource, and it's good for teaching because students aren't going to have access to libraries, at least in most places. Our library is closed. So I'm pointing all my students to Project Muse saying, look, you can get all these books, including books that were, you know, published last week, are available there. So, you know, they've both things that are scholarly works, but also things that are, things you might want to read for fun. That's all available. There are a number of digital transcription projects that I've been intrigued by and haven't done anything with before, but I thought this would be a good opportunity to do things with. There's a whole list of them that the AHA has up. Probably the one I know best is Information Wanted, which is about African Americans trying to find family members after the Civil War, and they've got these ads, and people go in and transcribe them to make them full text searchable. And the sort of Last Seen project, which is out of Villanova University. But there are a number of these projects that are taking manuscript sources and digitizing them. And I think that's, people are looking for ways to do something that is both, on the one hand, kind of mindless, but also something that actually is going to create a lot of value for historians in the future. That's a really sort of great way to spend some time. And the other thing I've done recently that I've really benefited from is I've participated in a couple of virtual happy hours with other historians. I don't know whether you've done any of this, Frank, but I've done a couple of these with the Southern Association for Women's Historians, which is open to men and women, despite the name. We're all sort of talking online via Zoom, which I guess is the group platform of preference nowadays. In parts of talking about our experience teaching, how in this weird online context we're all now in, and research and other kinds of things. But it's good for social networking. Well, it's kind of like the social networking that happens at conferences, but except it's, which I think is an important thing that you know, people who are your colleagues in the field, they are people that you trade ideas with intellectually, but they're also your friends. And this is a great way to sort of see them and check in with them and see how they are doing, and to talk about the kinds of issues we're facing right now with conferences being, all the conferences obviously this summer were canceled. And so I think this sort of fills an important social role that you get to be in a group of people talking, you know, we're talking about our students and talking about our, you know, experiences in lockdown in different places. So I would encourage people to, if you've got communities of, you know, historians, and I think most people who are listening to this are sort of historian or historian adjacent, these are great sort of ways to simply sort of check in with people for an hour or two.
I'm going to have a call tomorrow with my video call with all of my siblings because it's our mother's. It would have been our mother's birthday.
Oh, you see, and that, you know, that's a good, you know, you may not have done that prior to all this in some ways because we all would be out busy doing things. And so there's ways in which lockdown can create opportunities for talking to people you wouldn't have talked to otherwise, even if you're thousands of miles away.
Everybody's available.
Exactly. They don't have an excuse for not showing up.
Although we do live in this bizarre moment because this pandemic is serious, and the stories coming out of Italy and now New York and elsewhere are truly horrifying. And on one hand, we have people who live and work amongst us who are doing unbelievable and unbelievably important work to save lives and to keep society functioning, whether it's people stocking supermarket shelves or frontline healthcare workers. And on the other hand, the rest of us are sort of, okay, what are you binge watching on Netflix and so on. So we're in this kind of really bizarre, you know, on one hand, the analogies are being made. The president Trump called himself a wartime president a few days ago. And elements of this, I think if you're in a hospital in Bergamo or in Brooklyn, that's exactly the right analogy. But for the rest of us, we've just been asked to stay home.
Well, so, but the, you know, the rest of us in part depends on whether we are in a situation like you and I are in, where we've got
homes to stay.
We've got both homes to stay in, and we have work that we can do from home.
That's right.
You know, with the numbers of people are in situations where that's not possible. And you know, this is going to be a very different experience, even if they are in some ways also sitting at home binge watching things. They're facing a very sort of different potential future than you and I are.
No, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, it's just it's a very, very strange moment.
And it makes planning for the future very difficult. You know, I think that one of the things I think we're all facing is we don't know how long this is going to last. You know, we don't know. You know, are things going to get back to normal in, you know, 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years? And
what will normal be? So to use
and what will normal exactly
of our own profession? You're right. All the conferences have been canceled, and we're seeking alternatives. To, you know, maybe do we conclude that conferences aren't necessary, or do we conclude that they're more necessary than ever? I mean, I don't know. It's impossible to know, and that's a very small aspect. That's a not terribly important aspect of this, frankly.
But I think it's, you know, one of the things that these kinds of crises, you know, the things that seemed necessary and fundamental before, when you take them away, you sort of see, well, exactly how important they were or weren't. And so I think the reality we emerge to whenever this is all over, it may be different in profound ways you know, what our experience beforehand. So, but figuring out how to plan for all that's impossible. So it makes, I think, part of the anxiety everyone is facing is not only sort of how do we get through this, but what's going to look like when we all emerge from lockdown.
Well, for one thing, I don't know about you, but my lockdown beard is coming in quite nicely.
I'm continuing to shave, but usually only, you know, before Skype calls. The one of the things that sort of intrigued me in the past few days is just the terminology people have used for whatever this is. And the name that the media has embraced of a lockdown, I think, is an interesting choice of terms for this period, because it's in some ways what we're facing is a mass quarantine, right? I think that would have been the term for what this is, but that's not the term that gets used, whereas lockdown has become the vocabulary of whatever this is. Which I think is an interesting choice, because it's not a very old word, lockdown. I was sort of checking earlier today, and lockdown first gets used in 1973. So it's only a word.
Wow, it's that recent.
Yeah, and it's used initially in the context of prisons. So what happens to prisons when there are violence or what have you? They go into lockdown. And almost all the early usages of lockdown are in that context. And then after Columbine, the term gets shifted to what happens to schools in a school shooting or in a drill. So you have lockdown drills that have been going on for 20 years in schools, at least in the United States. So the sort of the transition of this term from being a term used in prisons to a term used in school shootings to now this kind of mass quarantining, I think, is an interesting sort of vocabulary choice. I think that says something. I'm not quite sure exactly what it says about the ways in which this is being imposed upon people, or people are choosing to go into lockdown. It's unclear whether this is, you know, the extent of coercion going on. Versus sort of voluntary action, but
well, that's I agree with you. It's very interesting, and I wonder what word is being used, what the equivalent word is in different languages. I mean, that would be an interesting study. I would say in our immediate British context, it's interesting because I think it was only a week ago. Last Friday when the Prime Minister Boris Johnson in his daily address said, actually, we need to take this more not more seriously, but we're more, you know, you need to stay home. And it didn't become a requirement to stay in until the following Monday, in part because making it a suggestion just didn't have that much force. And also the weather was very nice last weekend in the UK, especially in London, and people were out, and there were images of parks being, you know, parks filled with people, treating it as any other nice early spring day. And so they adopted more stringent language, although I don't think they said – I don't think he said the word lockdown, but I think it was, you know, we have now quite clear requirements that we are to stay at home unless we're going out to buy food or to exercise or to – if you're working – if you – have to leave home for work and it's essential work. And so they changed the language. And I think lockdown, because of its association, perhaps even with prison, you know, has that force. I mean, again, people are saying lockdown, but I think, you know, in Northern California, for example, it's a shelter in place order is the technical term. But certainly the press and on social media and in common parlance, people are saying lockdown. But I don't know what they're saying in, you know, Italian and French or Mandarin, for example.
Sure.
Interesting. That is interesting. I didn't realize the phrase that the word itself is of that recent vintage.
Well, we'll see how long this lockdown lasts, and how we will continue to record the podcast for the foreseeable future.
Yes, if anybody has any ideas, we're happy to talk about the coronavirus, but we're also happy to talk about other things. So if you have suggestions, or we meant to do a mailbag episode, we could take questions. But yeah, we're going to continue recording as long as somebody's listening.
Listening, exactly.
And so, Mike, this is for you this week.
All right, Frank. Until next week.
We're very grateful to our listeners.
Yes.
Do you have a last drop?
Well, so I do. So one of the books that I just started, this is part of one of these books that is now free on Project Muse, is a book by Grace Hale called Cool Town, How Athens, Georgia Launched Alternative Music and Changed American Culture. And Grace Hale is a historian at the University of Virginia. This is a book that was just published literally a couple of days ago by UNC Press, but it's now available and free for everyone in the world to read. But it's about, you know, Athens, Georgia, which is this really interesting college town that during the 1980s had this. So the 70s and 80s had this really interesting alternative music scene with, the two most famous bands are the B-52s and REM, that really sort of transformed music. And I've really only just started to dip into this book, but it's proving to be an interesting, kind of fun read, but a fun read written from perspective of, written by an academic. So something that's good escape from all of this.
Well,
what do you got, Frank?
I've got this is hot off the presses, not off the press, but within the past few hours, and it's the morning in the it's Friday morning here in the UK. Last night, Bob Dylan released a new song. I don't know that you know this.
You mean Nobel Prize winner Bob Dylan
is
still
Nobel Prize laureate Bob Dylan.
I hope he didn't go into a recording studio. I hope he recorded this from his home or something.
I suspect this was recorded some time ago. It's a 17-minute song called Murder Most Foul, and it begins with the assassination of JFK. And more or less trips through popular culture in the 50 or 60 years since then. I tweeted about this first thing. It's 17 minutes long. So if you're in lockdown, you've got plenty of time to listen to it. I said, if Leonard Cohen rewrote We Didn't Start the Fire, that would give you the sense of what this song is like. It's worth listening to.
Okay, that's an Alice's Restaurant territory, though, in terms of a commitment for a song.
It's a little bit like, and in the way it sounds, the reason I think he didn't record it recently is it's his last album of original music was in 2012, Tempest. And Tempest has a 15-minute song about the sinking of the Titanic and an 8-minute song about the death of John Lennon. And it's very much in keeping with those two songs. So I think it's probably of that vintage and was probably just sitting around. But he tweeted it last night, overnight our time, Thursday night, Friday morning in the UK. Give it a listen and let us know what you think.
All right.
Hey,
two musical recommendations. Great. Yeah,
there you go.
All right, Frank. Until next week, stay safe.
Yeah, you too.
Cheers.
David. Be well. And be well, all of our listeners. Bye.
Bye.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.